The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, welcome back to the show. I'm Justin Brierley. Today on The Profile, renowned pastor to skeptics in New York City, Tim Keller, joins me and Ruth Jackson to talk about his life, faith, and journey with cancer. This was recorded as a live show with unbelievable listeners. Now, if you'd like to join our next live unbelievable show, it's this Tuesday, the 7th of February. I'll be hosting two perspectives on sexuality, gender, and identity. And you can be part of that live audience by registering for it at unbelievable.live. It's absolutely free to attend. It's online. Just go to unbelievable.live to be part of it. For now, let's get back to some of the questions that came in for Tim Keller. Just sticking with the sort of the whole question of how we share our faith in these kinds of circumstances that we've been talking about, cancer and so on. Here's a question from Luke who says, any suggestions, please, for how to comfort non-Christian relatives with cancer, especially if they understandably don't want to really think about cancer or suffering generally, and especially not God? How do you have a pastorally sensitive kind of conversation with someone who's in that kind of position, Tim?
Well, some of them, that's a great question. I will never forget there's a page, I think, in a book by Joe Bailey, B-A-Y-L-Y. He was an old Inner Varsity Fellowship staff worker here in the United States long ago, like in, I think, the 50s. And or maybe 50s, 60s, something like that. And he wrote a book called A View from the Hearse, because three of his children, I think they're all sons, three of his seven children died. He outlived them. And he was writing a book on grief, The View from the Hearse. Okay. Mm. And he tells at one, I think a funeral or a wake or something like that, he said a friend came and sat down next to him and said, I know the Lord's working in this, and I'm praying for you. And I know that, you know, all things work together for good, and we just don't understand his ways. And we really have to trust in him, and he's compassionate. And, you know, it's so hard, but, you know, we can really trust him. And Joe, the author, said, I couldn't wait for him to leave. And then he said, another friend came by and sat down next to me, and never said anything until I said something, and was always supportive, always economical with his words, basically followed my leads, just showed a tremendous amount of support. And I hated to see him go. Mm. But I've never forgotten that page. And I do think that when it comes to someone that doesn't share your faith, I think the most important thing is for you to just show up. Mm. For them to see that you really are, they may know that you don't have the same belief system, and for you to show up and really be supportive and not, frankly, push any kind of faith down their throat, unless they ask questions. Mm. Or if they say, hey, put in a prayer for me or something like that. Mm. With the guy upstairs. Mm. Not that I believe in him, but I wouldn't mind. That sort of thing. Then you have an open door. But don't open the door yourself. You need to let that person open the door to talking about faith. Otherwise, just be incredibly loving and supportive, period.
Yeah. Great advice.
Again, just so many brilliant questions coming in. And this is another really practical question. And lots of people have sort of said that they've said that they also want an answer. So it feels like it would be a good one to ask you. This is from Paul Cowley. And he says, hi, Tim, have you ever struggled with anxiety during your treatment? And how did you cope with that practically?
Yes, it's very strange, though. Yes, I mean, before the joke about that term I mentioned, scanxiety, which I can tell other people have already, other people who have had cancer know exactly what I'm talking about. There's always some anxiety. For some reason, there are times in which the anxiety is worse than others. And I've never really been able to judge why, frankly. Sometimes it's just a lot worse. And I think you have to remember you're both a body and a soul. And sometimes I actually feel like if I'm not keeping up my exercise, for example, I mean, it can be as simple as that. If I'm not eating the way I should, and I mean, I really need to stay on a regimen to not gain weight, to not lose weight, to keep my exercise and my stamina up. I find the anxiety gets worse if I'm not exercising. And sometimes exercising is just hard because I don't have the energy I used to have, but I have to push myself. So to some degree, the anxiety seems to get worse when I'm just not doing all the other things. But ultimately, what I have to do is I've got to go to the Psalms. And don't listen, you know, you British people do not get, you know, a big head, but I take the Book of Common Prayers 30 days through the Psalms. You know, it's been broken down. I don't know, Cranmer, I guess, did it, but it's broken down. And you get through it morning and evening. And I'll just say this now. I've actually, Justin, you may know, or Ruth may know, I've been doing it on Twitter a little bit lately, is there is nothing like the Psalms to teach you. And if you're getting through it this fast, that if I'm anxious, you're going to have some Psalms about anxiety. There's Psalms where somebody is tearing you down and you've got enemies. There's Psalms about anxiety. There's Psalms about depression, Psalms about guilt. And if they're coming through, you know, 150 every 30 days, there's going to be Psalms about anxiety that just grab you. Mm. And so the way I deal with the anxiety is I keep my Psalms up and I keep my exercise up. And that's the best I can do.
Just a plug as well. You've written so many books, Tim. You might have even forgotten you wrote this one, but I really found helpful your devotional book, My Rock, My Refuge, which goes through the Psalms for the course of a year. And when you have to face all of them, even the kind of, you know, quite harsh imprecatory Psalms, it's actually really helpful to kind of just say, okay, yeah, there's a lot of human emotion in these Psalms, and it's okay.
Those psalms are sometimes you say, my goodness, why in the world would God have allowed that to be there? You know, Derek Kidner, you know, the great British Old Testament scholar, he says the fact that God allows these cries in the scripture shows he understands. And then he says he knows how we speak when we're desperate. So there's that one place, Psalm 137, where it says, blessed is he who does to you what you did to us and dashes the heads of your little ones like on the rocks. And you say, what's that doing in the Bible? Well, Derek Kidner says, isn't that amazing? God understands that sometimes that's how we feel. And that was so comforting to me. And so I do think I usually tell people going through anxiety, discouragement, that sort of thing, immerse yourself in the Psalms, because you'll find ways to process that particular emotion before God.
I've got a question here from Verstige, who has a question about prayer and what do we pray and what about unanswered prayer. So he simply asks, Pastor Tim, praying for recovery or healing is obviously not always answered. That would make some doubt God. So should I always pray for recovery, or is accepting that life as it comes is also a possible Christian response, that I'm simply sort of trusting God? Where do you fall on this question of how we pray, what we should pray when we're facing these kinds of situations?
Yes. I love the fact that the book of Job allows, at the end of the book of Job, if you have a very pietistic approach that says, well, you never complain to God. You never say, God, why are you doing this? Or why are you letting this happen? You get to the end of the book of Job, and God is vindicating Job and saying to his friends, you know, Job has pleased me, but you don't please me. And maybe if Job prays for you, I won't smite you. And we pietistic types, we read the book of Job and say, I'm surprised that God is not more critical of Job, at the very end, because it doesn't seem like Job was very respectful at various places. But I had an Old Testament professor at Gordon Conwell Seminary years ago, Dr. Meredith Klein, who says, the thing is, it's true that Job did very often, you know, shake his fist and complain and grump and cry out and fall down and chew on the rug, but he did it in front of God. Mm-hmm. He didn't walk away. He never walked away from God, because he was always talking to God about it. And therefore, God actually showed that Job beat Satan, because Satan said, does Job serve God for nothing? See, in other words, Job is really in it. He doesn't love you for yourself alone, the devil said to God in the beginning of Job. He loves you for what he's getting. So if you take away the profit margin, if it goes away, so it looks like what I'm giving to God is actually, exceeded by what I'm getting from God, then he's going to go away. Mm-hmm. And guess what? By the end, he never did that, which means God can make human beings into people who actually love him for himself alone. Now, you would never think that the way he was talking to God, that he was being all that loving. But as long as you don't walk away from God, as long as you're complaining and being upset, but you're still talking to him, that's what that shows that you love him for himself alone and not just for the good things he's giving you. Mm. So just don't stop praying. And that's actually a way of saying to God, I love you for who you are, not just for what you do for me. But on the other hand, be realistic. You don't have to, take a look at what Job says. You don't really have to tamp down those feelings.
Mm. I mean, what about that prayer that's specifically mentioned about prayer for healing? I mean, have you kind of had people praying for healing for you too?
Yes.
And how do you kind of, how do you square that theologically with the fact that obviously healing doesn't always happen?
Well, I pray, by the way, I would say at least twice a day, I pray for healing, complete healing, even though my doctor told me there is no cure for pancreatic stage 4. Once it's out there, you'll die of it. I've been praying for healing. God can do it or he doesn't have to do it. I mean, this is years and years of experience with him. When I look back on things that he did for me that at the time I thought were awful, but now I realize were actually good for me. It's just years of experience. I say, look, he knows. Mm-hmm. I mean, that may sound a little too easy for those of you who are saying, no, I can't die yet. I'm not young with children still at home. And I think that is really, really tough. On the other hand, when I got this cancer diagnosis, I was 69 years old. I remember Kathy and I looked at each other and said, we thought we'd feel a lot older when we got to 69. We always thought we'd feel like, hey, you know, my life's over. Mm. No. So it's not like we haven't struggled, but I think in the just years of experiences, the Lord, he knoweth. Mm. And I can't possibly be sure. He knows. So, I mean, ultimately, I'm praying for healing. And just the fact that I may not get that is something that I have to say, okay, God knows.
Mm. Tim, we've had quite a lot of questions about your prayer life. You mentioned earlier that you pray, satisfy me every morning with your steadfast love, which is brilliant. There's a question here from Lisa Harmon, which says, what specifically did you do to change your prayer life? I think that's kind of in relation to the fact that you were saying in some ways you wished that you and Kathy prayed how you do now post-diagnosis. But right. Is there something specific, I guess, that changed? And if so, what was that?
Well, I would say that this came in two stages. When I was in my 50s, the first time I had cancer, and it was thyroid cancer. I had my thyroid out. And there was a period there where, he maketh me to lie down. And he did. And during that time, I actually did have something of a renaissance in how I prayed. That's where I got into the Psalms at a much deeper level, where I worked through the Psalms and where I started praying them more often. I also started to do a better job of learning how to meditate. And I'd read that article. Well, it was a letter. You know, Martin Luther wrote a letter to his barber, who asked him, Master Luther, how should I pray? And he wrote a 40-page letter to him about prayer. But basically in that letter, which you can find online, and you kind of have to get through the first part of it. It's kind of, he's chatty, but eventually he gets to a place where he talks about a way of meditating so that it warms your heart up. And what he does is he would say, choose the idea, then do adoration, confession, supplications. Very interesting. Where you don't go from Bible study to prayer. You go from Bible study into meditation to prayer. Now, the difference between meditation and prayer is very simple. Take a look at Psalm 103. Okay. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits. Now, who's he talking to? That's not a prayer. He's talking to himself. Mm-hmm. And what he's actually doing is he's saying, do you really understand what this means? Do you see the benefits? You're you're meditating on them and thinking about them. John Owen would say, you're not just saying, oh, I know that Jesus Christ became a human being. He says, do you see the glory of it? Which I think John Owen means, think about the beauty of that. So you're meditating. You're not just, I read this thing in the Bible. Now I'm meditating on it till your heart is warm, until it begins to affect you. And there's a lot I've written in my book on prayer on that and others. And then you move to prayer. Now that all happened 20 years ago, where I added meditation and I added the Psalms. And I also added morning and evening rather than only praying in the morning. Those were the three things. But then what happened was when I got my cancer, it was a matter of more, you might say, turbocharging. I spent more time doing those things. Mm. So that was the and God obviously was getting me ready with the thyroid cancer for the pancreatic cancer. So I wouldn't say the change now was so much, it was this method as much as just giving it the time and being way, 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 way more regular.
Yeah.
Whereas the basic methods that I learned about 20 years ago, now I was using in a way that I never really got a chance to use them. So that's kind of a long answer, but I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, no, that's great. Helpful. Thank you.
There's a couple of questions on forgiveness specifically, which obviously we referenced earlier on in the show and the new book to that effect. Some kind of personal ones, some theological ones here. Hannah, for instance, says, how do I forgive when I know I need to, because God has forgiven me of all my sin and calls me to forgive, but I actually just want to walk away from the person and stay angry with them? So this is a really practical kind of real life question. What do you do when you just don't want to forgive someone?
Well, on the one hand, I do want to say, and this is a little on the side of the person, on the side of the part of you that really doesn't like the person. I want to say that forgiveness does not mean automatically learning to trust them. In other words, when I forgive somebody, it doesn't mean I have to trust them immediately. They have to re-earn my trust. And if they don't re-earn my trust, if they don't change, then I really don't know that you have to be, I don't think you have to be as intimate. You can forgive without being as intimate as you were before. I think some people say, well, if I forgive, that means I have to go back and do everything. Mm-hmm. Well, it's never loving to make it easy for somebody to sin against you. Mm. Think about that. It's not loving to the person. And so if you've got a person who just is very intemperate in what they say, I'll give you an example in 1 second. That doesn't mean you necessarily have to allow them to be intemperate in the way they talk to you. So you don't really have to, in order to forgive, you don't really have to necessarily trust them. If they don't change, if they don't make those kinds of changes, I don't think you have to do that. However, forgiveness means saying, I'm not going to revenge myself on the person. And secondly, I'm not going to keep replaying the recordings of what that person did to me. Because that's part of what makes you feel kind of noble. And it almost feels like it's a bit of payback. It's internal payback. And it's that's what forgiveness is, to say, the vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Lord, you know what this person deserves. I don't. I don't have the right to try to inflict judgment on them because I'm a sinner. Number two, I don't really know what they deserve because I don't know everything they've gone through. So I don't have the right. I don't have the knowledge, and I actually don't have the power to give them what they deserve. So I'm not going to pay them back. I'm not going to pay them back directly trying to hurt them, but I'm also not going to try to pay them back by thinking about how awful they are inside. You need to turn your heart away from replaying. I just show you how old I am. I used to say, don't keep replaying those tapes. Younger people don't know what tapes are. Said, don't keep replaying the tapes. Don't keep replaying that, because that keeps you angry and it keeps you locked in. Mm. Yeah. So I would say, no payback. That's what forgiveness is. I refuse to pay back. I'm not going to try to hurt the person, and I'm not going to replay that over and over and over again. Yeah. And I'm going to let God give the person what they deserve. Meanwhile, my relationship with them, I need to do as much as I possibly can to no, not ignore them, not stay away from them, not be discourteous to them, but if they don't make any changes.
And I'm sorry,
you know what? I can tell you one example. There is a woman who had an abusive father, I mean, an adult woman with a father who tended to abuse her verbally. Mm. And she said, I'm going to call you every Tuesday night, Dad, because you're my dad. But I want you to know that if you start to abuse me, I'm not going to say, Dad, stop it, or I'm not going to get angry at you. I'm going to hang up. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to call you back next week because I'm not mad at you. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to help you. And also, it's not right for you to do that. Yeah. And eventually, it's really interesting. 3 or 4 weeks in a row, he did a normal thing. And she just said, Dad, hanging up, and then called back. And eventually it changed him. So she was on the holding him accountable and still forgiving him. Sorry, Justin.
I was going to just follow up with another question that sort of comes, I suppose, on the heels of that. And I was going to say as well, to that person who's asking, how do I forgive when I want to forgive? Well, kind of in the same way that you said, you know, just being there before God and not walking away, even though you're angry and whatever, God sees that you're struggling and that you know you don't want to struggle.
Yeah.
And that is even just the wanting not to feel like this is a start for grace to potentially come through.
Absolutely, Justin.
Totally. Terry will also wants, so this has a more kind of specifically theological question here, who says, my understanding of the Christian God is that he requires sinners to repent and ask for forgiveness before he will forgive. If that's true, then why should we be expected to forgive regardless of whether or not the offender is repentant, says Terry. I'm not sure if Terry is a Christian himself, but he's got this question.
That's a great question. Now, if I was just going to beat you over the head with a Bible verse, it would be Mark chapter 11, verse 25. Now, of course, I'm going to be really nice about it. See, but Mark chapter 11, verse 25 says, if you stand, this is Jesus talking. If you stand praying and realize you have anything against anyone, forgive them. So it's a pretty blanket statement. Yet the questioner is right, because then in Luke 17, it says, if a person repents 70 times, 70 times, you have to forgive them. Well, it seems like a contradiction, except it's not. Hmm. If you want a reconciled relationship, the other person has to repent. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, you really can't have a reconciled relationship till that person repents. And I actually was alluding to that a minute ago when I said, if that person doesn't make any changes, you don't have to trust them and get back into that relationship. But on the other hand, I think you need to do an internal forgiveness where you say, I'm not going to do payback. Then you can go to them and call them to repent. And I can tell you something very interesting. If you don't forgive before you go to them, then you will probably go in order not just to help them, but to basically hurt them. And they can tell that the reason you're confronting them is to make them feel as bad as you feel like he made you feel or she made you feel. Mm-hmm. And therefore, generally speaking, if you don't forgive before you go to try to get that reconciled relationship, you do a lousy job of it. The other person just sees that you're just trying to hurt them, and then they get their back up and you never get them to change at all. So, but the main difference is that the reason you need to forgive, even though the other person has repented, at least internally, is because you're a sinner and they're a sinner. Whereas when God forgives, God is holy. God is perfect. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the best way to answer that, I think.
Brilliant. Thank you, Tim. Just as we're sort of wrapping this up, this feels like a really great question. It's from Matthew, and he says, what do you know after decades of ministry that you wish you knew fresh out of seminary? And his context is that he's about to wrap up his own MDiv and look for a pastorate in his area. And if it's not too presumptuous, I'd love to just add my own question to that, which is, you know, what do you wish you knew at the beginning of your cancer diagnosis that you've sort of learned in the past few years that you kind of wish you could go back and say to yourself?
Well, the first question is a lot easier than you might think. It's and actually the two answers I'm about to give you are pretty similar, though. There is no doubt that everybody told me at seminary, you got to have a prayer life. I just, you know, going back, I just wish I had seen how important it was. Mm-hmm. I just didn't. There is no doubt about it that the prayer life, which is the prayer time, was often squeezed out by things I had to get done because people asked me to do this and I never finished it last night. So I get up early in the morning. I got to do it before I get into work. And where does it come from? It comes from your prayer time. Mm-hmm. And that is just, that's just wrong. And it's very clear that, in other words, what people think of me is more important than what God thinks of me. That their high regard, oh my goodness, you're getting so much done, is more important than God's regard. When I look back on it, just that very fact that I was constantly letting what people thought about me, overcome and veto my time with God. That was the main thing. I knew that would sort of happen, but boy, I didn't realize it just took a terrible toll on me. I could have been a far better minister if I just said, no, I can't. I'm sorry if somebody's going to say, you promised that it'd be done by the end of the month. And instead I got up and I prayed because that was at the time. And I just very seldom did that. Yeah. I just really needed to make sure people were okay. And it's similar, I'd say, my answer is that what I said before, and that is, I wish I'd been able, without getting cancer, to just know how mortal I am. Mm. And Psalm 90 says, teach us to number our days that we get a heart for wisdom. What does that mean? I know what it means now. Mm. But I don't know how you do that before you really have something like this. I just don't know. There's just a breakthrough in the way in which I look at everything. Once I realized, my goodness, I've been in denial. So I guess, I hate to do that, Ruth, to you, but I mean, I basically would answer your question with reference to what I said before. I'm not sure there is a way. It's actually, Kathy's mother had five children. We only had three. But Kathy's mother used to say to her, I want to write a book someday, how to raise the first child like the fifth, which meant not so worried, not so upset, really relaxed. And Kathy said, that's impossible, Mom. I don't care. There's no way you can possibly raise the first child like the fifth. Never, ever, ever. Because you just have to go through it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're going to have to go through having that first child and being worried about it. Why is she doing that? Why is she just upset? Should I take her to the doctor? And by the time you get to the third, fourth, fifth child, you realize they're resilient. The same thing. There's no way to get to where I am now, I think, without going through the doctor saying, you're going to die from this. Mm-hmm. I wish there had been, but there isn't. But I'm glad I'm where I am.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being with us tonight, Tim. It's a great place to end it, actually, with that call to put prayer first as we enter a new year. It's often the thing that people try, sometimes fail to do, obviously, but it's been certainly an inspiration for me as well to hear you say that.
Thank you. Both to you. Right back at you, as we say here.
Thank you for listening to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. You can catch the podcast anytime over at premierchristianradio.com/The Profile. And do check out Premier Christianity magazine, where this interview with Tim Keller is featured as the cover story in the latest issue. And you can get that issue plus the next two print ones for just £5. Go to premierchristianity.com/subscribe. That link is with today's show if you're listening via podcast. For now, I've been Justin Brierley, and there'll be another fascinating guest on The Profile next week. For now, thanks for listening, and see you next time.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity magazine.
My wife and I would never want to go back to the kind of prayer life and spiritual life we had before the cancer. Never. Wow. The way you look at your time, the way you look at God, the way you look at your spouse, the way you look at everything just changes when you actually realize time is limited and I'm mortal.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to this week's Profile with me, Justin Brierley, brought to you in partnership with Premier Christianity Magazine. It's the monthly mag with the best of Christian journalism, interviews, news, and features. And today you're going to hear myself and Ruth Jackson in conversation with renowned pastor, author, and Christian thinker Tim Keller, who led Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City for over 25 years. We'll be talking about his life and faith, his new book on forgiveness, and his recent journey with cancer too. We were joined by unbelievable listeners for this live show, and you'll hear their questions. This conversation with Tim Keller is featured as the cover story in Premier Christianity this month, and you can get that issue plus the next two print ones for just £5 at premierchristianity.com/subscribe. That link is with today's show if you're listening via podcast. For now, let's dive in. Welcome, Tim.
You've had a bit of a love affair with the Brits. You frequently have come over in your time here, Tim. What's the connection there? Why as a primarily a US-based pastor and speaker and thinker and author, have you connected so much, do you think, with the UK?
Yes, my guess, my wife and I, we believe that probably up until the pandemic happened, there was probably almost a 30-year period in which we came almost at least a couple times a year. Hmm. And the reasons were very diverse. In the very beginning, it was actually my Presbyterian roots. And I would come and largely talk to Presbyterian groups. But then what happened was, which, you know, took me to Scotland more to the, but eventually it accumulates, you know, somebody hears you and says, oh, I want you to come back and talk to my group. And it just got accumulated. Also, we just also developed not just ministry colleagues, but friends, real friendships. I don't know if they're on, but for example, Ray and Jill Lane in Ambleside, which isn't a bad place to have friends. I just want you to know Ambleside, the Lake District. And so we started to take holidays there too. So that's why.
Oh, that's really nice. Well, look, we've got people joining us from all over the world, not just the US and UK. Ruth, do you want to read out where some of these folks are joining us from?
Yeah, so we've got a couple of people from Sydney, Brooklyn, Sweden, Ontario in Canada, Ontario.
That's
definitely
right.
Not saying that right. New Jersey.
Ontario. Come on. Use your nose.
Ontario.
You don't use your nose when you talk.
We've got, Tokyo, Japan, Norway, Manila in the Philippines, Berlin, Germany, London, Scotland, Netherlands. I mean, it feels like everywhere.
It's a very international gathering.
Jamaica, I've just spotted.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, feel free to continue adding where you're watching or listening from in the chat. It's wonderful to have lots of people joining us for tonight's discussion with Tim. Tim, we've titled this Walking with God Through Cancer, and because obviously that has dominated obviously your story over the last couple of years. Tell us just firstly, what is the latest with your health and treatment and so on?
Well, they put it in a capsule form. I was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer in May of 2020. That, as you all know, that's a very, very deadly kind of cancer. And yet I'm about to celebrate my third Christmas with my family. So the reasons for that is I had 2 years of chemotherapy here in New York City, and it kind of kept the cancer at bay somewhat. And now I'm in an immunotherapy drug trial at the National Institute for Health in Bethesda, Maryland. And that is actually working too. So my cancer is still there. Pancreatic cancer can break out anytime and take you. And yet we've been able to keep it somewhat at bay for a pretty long time. And so we're very grateful.
Mm. I mean, Tim, this might be really hard for you to define, or it might be something that you've thought about a lot, but what would you say are some of the kind of highs and lows over this past 2 years, this journey that you've been struggling with?
Well, Ruth, it wouldn't be surprise to anyone else with cancer or anyone who has friends or loved ones with cancer that you have to constantly have scans. In other words, you get scans and tests, and they happen. It depends. They can happen every month, every 2 months, every 3 months. And I have to say that coming right up to those scans, we have a word called scansiety. Mm. Because you know that it doesn't matter how good the last one was, this one could show that it's out of control.
Yeah,
every single time. And so the low lights are every time you're going in and you're waiting for the test results. And so, I mean, that's obviously one. And the other is that every little ache and pain that you in the for most of your life, you say, well, that's probably nothing. And now you say, is that the cancer? The highlights, and this is going to sound like an exaggeration. My wife and I would never want to go back to the kind of prayer life and spiritual life we had before the cancer. Never.
Wow.
I spent all my life saying that communion with God, the real presence of God, you know, satisfy us this every morning with your steadfast love, which is definitely a request for experience. So what does it mean? Satisfy us every morning with our, with your steadfast love. That can't mean remind me. It means satisfy me with your love. And I spent all of my career telling people it was available and experiencing some of it. But actually, every so often, Kathy and I will say we're having a much better life now.
Wow. Wow, that's quite remarkable. Just sticking with the journey you've been on, though, in the last couple of years there, Tim, I remember, I think it possibly the last time I connected with you on the show was to talk about your book, Walking with God Through Suffering. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that was written in a different time of your life. Is there anything you would revisit now, you know, having spelled out the theory, now that you've kind of lived the practice of it? What was there anything you'd write differently or think differently now?
No. Now, I'll tell you, I hope that doesn't sound arrogant. The fact was that I wrote that, let's see, I guess I was already 60 something, and I'd already been in ministry for 35 years. And therefore I walked with an awful lot of suffering people who suffered worse than I did. And so I learned that from the Bible and pastoral experience, not from personal experience. But it turns out, I guess, that most of the people I walked with, the things that helped them, the things that comforted them, the things that you might say worked for them. I mean, obviously, work doesn't mean get rid of the pain or the suffering. It means that you can endure it and even grow in it. And those things actually have worked for me, using the term work that way.
I mean, Tim, do you think there's anything that you would say that you've learned in this time that you perhaps didn't know before? I mean, you mentioned walking alongside people, and obviously you would have experienced suffering, but I guess nothing to this extent from a personal perspective.
Well, yes, I already mentioned the fact that it's almost like when it comes to prayer, I really thought that I, you know, had a good prayer life. And when I broke through into another dimension, I realized, my goodness, I was much, much, much less. Frankly, my prayer life wasn't very good. But the other thing I would say is everyone knows they're going to die. And yet everyone knows that they really, in some ways, repress that and live as if they're never going to die. We all know that. We all say that. But it's not till you have not just cancer. I had thyroid cancer when I was age 52. But the first thing the doctor said is, this is very treatable. Pancreatic cancer, the first time I talked to a doctor, my doctor says, you're going to die of this. It's sooner or later, because we don't have a cure for it. And I realized I never really did believe I was going to die. At some deep level, I just didn't. And I don't think there's, looking back on it, I don't think there's any way to go through the change that happens in you when you know you really are going to die. The way you look at your time, the way you look at God, the way you look at your spouse, the way you look at everything just changes when you actually realize time is limited and I'm mortal. And I would have lived a better life if, frankly, in my 40s, I'd been able to do it.
Yeah.
There is some kind of denial that's there that just will not go away until you actually have a doctor saying, you're going to die of this, and you could die of this within weeks. It all depends.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
I mean, obviously, this whole period has forced you as a very active person in ministry and so on to step back, to put a lot of things on hold. How have you coped with, as it were, being less active in a kind of forced way because of this?
Justin, it's been great. The thing I saw was that I actually was too active.
Right.
And I'd been too active for too long. And even though I am still less active than I, if I was, didn't have the cancer, I'd probably be a little more active than now. But it's actually, I'm closer to where I should have been most of my life. I am very blessed in that God did not make my, my relationships with my sons are good. My sons are believers. I'm got a great relationship with my wife, and I'm that is nothing but God's grace, because I was too active. And everybody, I felt like everybody said, you have to do this for me. And okay, I have to do this for you. And no, the answer is it's been great to be less active. It's been good for everybody around me and me.
Tim, your latest book, as Justin mentioned, is called Forgive.
I'm holding it up now.
There we go. Get a look at that. Why this topic of forgiveness, and why now, in the midst of everything you're going through?
By the way, Ruth, I could have dedicated it to Justin, because the number of times he's asked me to be on this program and I've said no, he's clearly a very forgiving person. So he could have been dedicated to him. He came in third, though. So I...
Endless patience with you, Tim. Endless patience. No, seriously.
Well, I did sense that we have a more that we're losing in the West. We're losing our grip on the value of forgiveness. We have more and more people not only showing that they will not forgive, they don't forgive. They're pretty harsh and combative in their general demeanor and the way in which they talk to people. But some just speak right out and say forgiveness is not a good idea. And what I try to say in the book is there's partly that I understand that, because forgiveness in many cases has been abused, as when you say to a woman in a church who's been sexually abused, and you come to her and you say, well, you know, you have to forgive your perpetrator. He repented. So you need to meet together, and he repented. You have to forgive, and you can't go to the police. You can't, you know, so that's an abuse. that's an abuse.
Yeah.
But because the reality is that forgiving is not opposed to seeking justice. As a matter of fact, if you don't forgive, you won't seek justice. You'll seek vengeance, which always is going past what justice demands, and it always eats you up. So I would say you do need to forgive and pursue justice. It's not either or. But right now in our culture, the mindset is that forgiveness is the opposite of justice. And since everybody's, especially younger people, are very concerned rightly about justice, forgiveness doesn't seem to fit with that. Yeah. So I thought I'd write a book that just lifted up the biblical material, but tried to apply it to our cultural moment.
When it comes to our cultural moment, it feels like, I know exactly what you mean when you say we're living in a sort of more graceless kind of culture. How do we, I don't know, swim against that tide? Because we're all to some extent, I think, being swept up in these culture wars where it's a very combative, divisive, you know, kind of game. What do you think? What can Christians do to sort of be, I guess, Jesus in the culture we're living in?
I'm not really going to be able to give you some real great answer, Justin. Everybody's going to say, wow, Tim really. No, I think the answer is we have to do it with great difficulty and tenacity, which is to speak the truth in love. If you're not clear about what Christians believe, then there's no possibility of persuasion. But if you're not loving in the way in which you speak, there is also no possibility of persuasion. And Paul says, you know, we persuade. And the idea is not to either cozy up to people, you know, and just get them to like you if they have a different opinion, but at the same time, not to pour out on them and just and bash them. So I think it's very difficult, because right now that's just not what's out there. And so I don't have a secret. Mm-hmm. There's no secret sauce.
I mean, interestingly, though, your name came up probably 6 months or more ago in regard to this sort of whole question of how should Christians conduct themselves in the midst of these questions, because there was an article written which questioned whether we need to move on, essentially, from the from the winsome style of Tim Keller that maybe was suitable for a kind of what it called neutral culture, where Christianity, while not being reviled, was not particularly praised. It was somewhere in the middle. Now it says, hey, we've moved on to a culture where Christianity is seen in negative terms. And it's almost a bit like you've got to fight fire with fire. You know, you've got to go in with a more kind of combative, assertive. You can't just say, hey, let's all try and be friends and speak in a winsome manner. So you got, I guess, you know, your whole sort of way of doing things was being questioned and challenged in that kind of conversation that was going on in social media at the time. I'm sure you got wind of that, Tim.
Yes.
What's your feeling on that whole sort of, you know, debate that sparked?
I'll say two things pretty brief.
Yeah.
Because I still think this is a little more of a US issue than a UK issue. And in the United States, up until fairly recently, if you lived in big parts of this country, especially in the Southeast or the Midwest, or even lots of the West, at least away from the coasts, Christianity was seen either as a positive or as in a neutral way. It was either regarded as positively or neutrally. Okay. That was not the case in the Northeast. In New York City, when I got here in 1989, no. It was much more like it has been in the UK for a very long time, or Europe, which is Christianity is seen as sort of, at least, just, you know, we tried that, it didn't really work. I mean, that's the European approach. We tried that, it doesn't really work. And it is negative. I mean, not necessarily always hostile, because British people tend to be just a little more courteous than America, but it's certainly disdainful. And an awful lot of Christians in America just did not experience that until fairly recently. And so they say, well, the Tim Keller winsome approach doesn't work. Well, listen, the Tim Keller approach was forged in New York City. And I'm sorry, it was never a neutral or positive world. So whatever you say about my approach, I was forged in a negative world. The second thing, though, is, and this is really where it becomes more US than UK, and this is the people who are saying it's time not to be so winsome. These are folks who actually want to change the political world here. They would like the state to be more overtly Christian. They want Christians to be much more politically active in bringing that about. I think that's a little bit hard for most of us, like my British Christian friends, to even understand. And what they therefore don't want, and you can't be winsome there. You basically have to get political.
Yeah.
And a lot of folks feel like my approach has always been to say, and I will say it right now, is whatever our political future is, and there is a problem. In fact, it is also true in Europe, too, that there's a rise of the right, there's the left. There's no doubt there's instability, and I don't know the way forward. But I think that there's room for differences of opinion amongst Christians who are united on the gospel. But they would rather not say that over here. They would rather say, no, the Christian church has to be aligned with a particular political agenda. And that's really their motive, I think. And I think it's a little hard. Frankly, I do find it hard because we're very much in touch with people in Africa and Christians in Africa, China, Europe. And they're trying to say, what's going on there?
Yeah.
What in the world? Yeah. And I said, well, you have to understand right now there's a movement among some Christians who say we have to be more politically aligned.
There's some interesting comments in the comment section as well, sort of, you know, saying what it's like in their context. And do please keep those comments coming, and do also keep your questions coming, because we're going to be throwing to your questions very soon. But before we do that, Tim, over the past year, you've published a series of sort of lengthy essays on Gospel in Life, on the decline and renewal of the American church, and sort of presenting its challenges and opportunities. Obviously, you're speaking within a US context, but I'm well aware that you have a pretty good handle on the global church. So what are some of your main fears for the church right now? And I guess on the flip side, what gives you hope for the future of the church in the West?
Well, I'll give you three of each.
Excellent.
It's not just
a true preacher.
A true preacher. Yeah, except that they don't all start with the letter P, because I'm not Welsh. I'm American. Well, the three fears are when people lose their hope that the church can actually thrive in our modern culture. When they lose hope, there's three things they can go into. One is you compromise on doctrine. You compromise on historic faith and practice. You say, we're just going to have to change that because we'll never get accepted. So you compromise. The second possibility is you withdraw into high walls around the church, and you basically are just going to keep hold of your kids and grow the church biologically, like the Amish. Okay. And the third is you get very combative and you say, we're going to try to take over the culture and let Christians run things. And I do fear that all three of those are certainly possibilities in the United States. And my guess is different parts of the world would be different. The three hopes are the growth of the global church. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about it that overall Christianity is growing. And by the way, it tends to be shrinking in places where the, as you know, the birth rate is also shrinking. And what that does mean is overall, you looking forward, Christianity is not going away in any way at all. It's growing and it will continue to grow. The second hope I have is that Jesus actually said the gates of hell are not going to prevail against my church. You know, and there's no, like I like to say, there's no expiration date on that offer. And then lastly, I actually think secularism looks exhausted, but I'm not going to, that's my, I don't, it doesn't look to me like it's really confidently saying we really have all the answers to all the basic human problems. So you put all that together, I got a lot of hope, but I still have a lot of fear.
Yeah. The church is not perfect, but it's often a lot better than secular humanism in terms of the answers.
Again. Yeah.
Well, look, so much I wish we could continue talking about, but we must go to some questions from our audience tonight.
I'll dive in with the first question. There's so many brilliant questions and really honest, heartfelt questions. So thank you so much for sharing so honestly. This is from Joseph, and he says, I'm a primary caregiver for my mother who has stage 4 skin cancer, and she's definitely had those lows that you spoke of. When she has those lows, what do you think is the most helpful thing for me to do to push her closer to Jesus, as we both know that the end is very likely near?
Well, here's what I'd like to do, and it's almost a trick, and that is to say, I want to pray for you. Now, you say mom, dad, whoever. You say, I'd like to pray for you, but tell me, I want to go to God right now and pray for you, but is there anything in particular you'd like me to be praying for? Anything in particular? What that does is, first of all, make sure if you have time. Because very often, if you say if you're actually saying, "Can I pray for you before we leave?" That means you got to go. But if you actually say, "How can I pray for you? In what way?" Then very often you'll have a 5, 10, 15 minute conversation where the person pours something out that's really bothering him or her. That is great. That for just to have you listen in a non-judgmental way. And say, of course you feel that way. Absolutely you would feel that way. And so if you're able to simply just non-judgmentally be there and then pray to God, which takes a little bit of, that's the reason I read the Psalms. You know, what you have in the Psalms is every single possible situation processed in prayer, every single human possible situation. So the more you read the Psalms, the more you'll know how to pray. But basically, that's what I would do, is I would say, can I pray? And you know what? It doesn't really matter what the person's faith or beliefs are. I've never seen that be turned down. That's one possibility. That's just one idea.
Thank you. I mean, we've got lots of very practical, personal kind of questions here, pastoral questions, really. And we should say, as often say on my other podcast with N.T. Wright, when these pastoral questions come in, do seek wise counsel from someone not on a screen from a real life pastor. Yeah. But Amanda in San Diego firstly says, Pastor Tim, I'm a new Christian, truly enjoy your sermons, listen to them frequently. I am fighting stage 4 colon cancer as a single mum with 2 kids. It is quite a roller coaster as I basically live from scan to scan and treatment to treatment. Yeah. Truly appreciate your prayers and guidance as I navigate this new way of living with cancer. Amanda doesn't have a question, but actually I just wanted to acknowledge that and say thank you, Amanda. But there is a question from someone else who's kind of on the other side of this. Someone who says, I've been caring for my mum who has terminal cancer and has had for several years, and I'm struggling to keep going. Mm-hmm. Caring for her, also serving in ministry. The Lord has been so good and gracious, but it's hard to be still in his presence given all the demands pulling on me. Do you have any guidance on balancing care for others with maintaining our first love relationship in Christ in this season of my life. This experience has exposed the depths of my own sin and selfishness. So I'm often overwhelmed by shame and my own inadequacy. Mm. Sorry, Tim. Carry on.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I'm sorry. That was very important to hear. And I almost interrupted. On the one hand, I would say, I should bring my wife in here because you're asking a question of her. On the other hand, interestingly enough, 20 years ago, my wife has Crohn's disease, but she had it in a way that was very debilitating 20 years ago. And where I was the caregiver, in fact, it's one of the strange things is we always thought that I was going to outlive my wife. And actually, we've had to spend a lot of time readjusting our idea that it's very possible that she'd outlive me. And that actually has been very difficult for us both, because we've just gotten into the groove of that. But as a caregiver, I do remember, and she would tell me this, she would say, it doesn't help me if you get yourself to the place where you are just utterly burned out. It just does not help me in the long run. And therefore, she said, please don't make unnecessary sacrifices. In fact, that's her term. I'll just lay this on you. An unnecessary sacrifice is one that makes you feel good in the short run. I did that. And yet it actually, it's you're eating into your principle. Now, you know the difference between, in other words, it's like in an endowment, you don't want to give so much away every year that you eat into the principle. So eventually you're out. Yeah. The endowment has to produce, it produces because it's invested and it produces, and then you give away what the profit is from the investment, but you don't get into the principle. And she would say unnecessary sacrifices make you feel virtuous. And partly, frankly, when you're a caretaker, you feel a little guilty that you're better than the other person. I do remember that. But I felt kind of guilty that I wasn't in pain. I wasn't hurting. I could just get up and go. And it was almost a way to over sacrifice and over almost burn myself out was almost a way of my saying, I'm with you in all this. And that she would come back and say, this isn't going to help me if you utterly burn out and you get to the place where you don't have any energy. And so at certain points, just create a boundary so that you don't eat into your principles, so that you can be with me for as long as you need to be. I hope that helps. That's what I remember from being a caregiver, even though I'm not one right now.
That's really helpful.
That's really helpful.
Principles.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. And there's a great question here from Raj, which I think echoes probably my questions and lots of people's questions about, you know, how could you possibly believe that God exists in the middle of everything you're going through? And, you know, when you don't see him necessarily at work in your life. And so what Raj says is, Pastor Tim, could you please relate a time in your life when you did see God's power manifest so clearly that no other explanation is plausible?
No. Now I'll tell you why. I would say that I actually do not doubt the existence of God, because the evidences I've seen are cumulatively overwhelming. But I think what the questioner is asking is, did you have a particular instance, you know, some event that all by itself was enough to say, now I know there has to be a God? No. And I'm not sure I would know. Now, partly because this is one of the reasons why I think British people like me a little more than a lot of Americans, is I'm a skeptical person. I tend to be skeptical. I'm just not, and therefore, because I tend to be skeptical, I can't imagine one thing that would happen that would make me say, well, there can't be any doubt, because you can always doubt. But cumulatively over the years, both intellectually and personally and socially, I've seen people change. I've experienced people that I don't believe are capable of the great things that they are capable of without God. I've thought these things out. I mean, Justin is, in some ways, Justin's, your whole program there is all about why Christianity actually does make sense and the alternatives make less sense. That's one of the reasons I'm a Christian, is that the alternatives, I don't have all the answers, but the alternatives have even fewer.
Yeah.
And if you put the intellectual and the social and the experiential, and right now the reality of God that I'm experiencing in my prayer life all together, I'm just over the top in certainty. But I can't give you one. And I'm not sure. I'm not sure there is one, but that's because maybe I'm a Tim Keller skeptic.
You're listening to The Profile on Premier Christian Radio, brought to you in partnership with Premier Christianity Magazine. I'm Justin Brierley, and my conversation, along with Ruth Jackson with Tim Keller, continues after a short break.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.